Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Monday, everyone. This is your host, Melissa Bilardi. We are recording live and podcasting all about help for Huntington's disease. The goal every week is to introduce incredible special guests to educate and inspire you. We now have more than 7,100 listeners. Thank you for your support and interest in Help for HD programming. Our call-in numbers for interactive questions tonight are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1. I'll cue you into the show. Please tell all your friends and family about Help for HD and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. I am extremely excited to introduce Dr. Diana Rosas, MD, who is director of the Center for Neuroimaging of Aging and Neurodegenerative Disease at Massachusetts General Hospital in Charleston, Massachusetts. She is also co-principal investigator for the CREST-E study. CREST-E, again, stands for Creatine Safety, Tolerability, and Efficacy in Huntington's Disease. And tonight we're going to talk about the role of neuroimaging in clinical studies. That's a mouthful, and it's exciting to have Dr. Rosas on the show. Specifically, we're going to be talking about CREST-E. This is the series has been very educational and informative, and tonight is the third and final episode in the CREST-E series. Please visit on-demand episodes on this site for part one and part two of this series for the full spectrum of this incredible study. And welcome to Help for HD, Dr. Rosas. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate the invitation to talk. I've been really excited about this, and I think the work that you're doing is absolutely wonderful. It's just phenomenal that how passionate you are about what you do and what an incredible service I think you do for the community. So I think we're all grateful to you as well as clinician scientists who are also trying to get the word out.
Well, this technology is just amazing. I mean, I can be anywhere in the world and host the show. So I'm looking forward to a long, blog talk radio career. And, I want you to first tell us a little bit about yourself and why is your focus on HD, and then we're going to move into a couple of other subjects before we go into neuroimaging. But tell us about yourself.
Oh, sure. So, I think it's a kind of rather convoluted story, but I was a resident at Massachusetts General Hospital, and the chief of the neurology service to this day is Anne Young, and she was an instrumental with Nancy Wexler in the Venezuela, the U.S.-Venezuela collaborative initiative to looking at research in Huntington's, and this is actually the group that really facilitated the discovery of the gene that causes Huntington's. And I was very fortunate, actually, to be exposed to Huntington's during my senior year in residency. And at that time, I had never seen Huntington's disease and knew really nothing about it. But I spoke Spanish, and I was invited to come. And I'll tell you, it was just one of the most, this day has been the most singularly inspirational period of my life. And frankly, I had already at that point signed up to do a fellowship in another neurodegenerative disease because I've been really interested in things that happen to the brain, both as just part of what happens when people get older, but more specifically in things when, that sort of almost natural aging process is accelerated in some of these other disorders like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and, Huntington's disease. And what happened over a period of time is, I almost by coincidence or by accident got involved in the first ever clinical trial in Huntington's disease, which is the CARE-HD study. And at that time, I was given the duty of getting involved with the chemistry analysis using magnets, these big MRI machines, to look at the chemistry using another nutritional supplement to see if we could pick up changes. But that was really my secondary job. But over time, I became more and more interested, in these patients and the things that they were facing. And, HD is such a compelling, disease. It's compelling scientifically. It's compelling on a really personal level, and it just became more and more of what I was doing, and I had more and more questions, and I found at that time that many of the questions that I had about what was going on were not even being addressed, and for me, it was a lot of the the imaging pieces of trying to understand what is happening to the brain over time in this disorder and how some of those changes can explain some of the things that you see that patients suffer from. So, you know, for, you know, when you looked at the literature, everything was based on, you know, the a part of the brain called the basal ganglia, which is where a lot of the outflow comes in, a lot of the movements, the chorea, the dystonia, the slowness of movements, and the poor it was really focused on a lot of these things related to the basal ganglia changes in that structure, because that structure is really, really devastated. Those group of structures are devastated in Huntington's. But as I got involved in the MRIs, which we needed to do looking at the structure also as we were looking at the chemistry, it became clear that there was a lot more going on. And as I got to know patients, more and more patients, I became more and more interested in just how different people are, both in terms of how they, you know, how the disease presents itself, when it presents itself, and how rates of change can be so highly variable. So I've been, you know, at this point, it is really what I do for most of my research in terms of just, you know, with Huntington's disease and various aspects. And one of them is biomarker development. And biomarker is basically something that you can measure in an objective and sensitive way that gives you information that tells you very directly about the disease. So there are biomarkers of what we call in Huntington's, at least, disease onset, things that can tell us earlier and perhaps more precisely, we hope, than the clinical exam, that things are starting to happen. And then things of, you know, biomarkers of progression, things that tell us how the disease is changing over time. And I think both of these have incredible potential utility in clinical trials and in drug development and even in pharma companies coming in, because you want to start something as early as you can. And certainly you want to try to stop the disease or, you know, try to interfere before things have gone too far. And we all know that things are happening years, even decades, perhaps, before motor symptoms develop. Mm-hmm. And then once things mm-hmm. develop, you don't want to have to do a phase 3 study the way they're powered now. Right now, in order to do a phase 3 study, you need to study 600 or 650 patients, and you have to follow them for 3 or 5 years before you have enough people to answer the basic questions of, is this drug actually changing the course of disease? And that's different from a symptomatic drug, right? You have drugs that are treating symptoms, for example, where you can monitor that symptom clinically. But when you're looking at something that may actually change the way the disease changes over time itself, you want something that will give you a more objective, more sensitive, and reliable measure than a clinical trial. So it's a long-winded story, but basically I just, you know, Huntington's is what I do, and it is a very compelling disorder, and it's absolutely fascinating. And the patients are always inspiring to me. They come in with their stories. They're very unique, and it's just been an incredibly fulfilling experience professionally for me to be involved with these wonderful people.
I actually posted some of the scatter plots that you sent me. Dr. Rosa sent me an amazing, incredible, chock full of information manuscript that I can hardly decipher because it's in doctor language and research language, but I was able to decipher some of it, and it's very fascinating. I would imagine that you are finding patterns with not only with the neuroimaging, but with the other biomarkers and actually seeing the patient. So how is that coming about?
You know, again, we are incredibly fortunate to have a wonderful group of people that come into all of our various research programs, and a big focus has been in this sort of biomarker development. So we have, in the same individuals, people who come in for MRIs, they come in for blood studies, and they come in for a series of assessments. And so what we're trying to do is try to understand, again, how we can explain on a structure level, you know, what's happening to the brain over time. And we can use a lot of different ways to look at the brain. You can look at what it looks like, what the anatomy is. We're at a point now when many groups are looking at the connections between brain regions, because those are actually critical. They're the cables that the brain cells use to communicate with other brain cells. And we're finding that those are really, really affected early on in Huntington's disease. We can look at, again, the chemistry of the disease. We can measure certain chemicals. And then there are other things. You can look at how the brain's working under certain conditions or even at rest.
I'm sorry. Are you looking at the brain images to see what basically what stage a person is in?
Well, you know, I think that we're trying to see. So one of the things in our biomarker program, and again, you know, CRESTI is the first study in Huntington's disease that's actually trying to has added some imaging component to try to see if we can use imaging down the road as one of the indicators of efficacy. Does this drug actually do what it's supposed to do? And in the case of creatine, slow things down. And basically, again, the scans are done so that you can measure at time point one and then the next time point to get a sense of how things are changing. One of the things that's been clear to me, both clinically, but I'm seeing so many patients, is that everyone's a little bit different. And when you have that kind of variability, you have to currently put all the variants together. You have to analyze everybody together. The goal is down the road, you may be able to more individually look at individual rates or individual differences. And again, that's the hope down the road, more tailored approaches, or maybe you can be more selective about, you know, this kind of thing or that, or you can get a better sense of where people are in disease. Right now, we don't have a good way to indicate where people are, but again, that would be one of the goals down the road, is to see where they are. We use a clinical measure now called the total functional capacity to give us a sense of where people are. You know, that's what the stages are based on when we look at the stage of Huntington's. But again, you may one day envision the possibility of using an MRI or a combination of things that, you know, we're seeing a number of things in the blood as well. Dr. Hirsch had mentioned in his, you know, in his session something called 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine, 8-OH-2-DG, which is a marker of increased inflammation in the system. It's a marker of oxidative stress is what we call. And so we see that you can measure this early on. It's not clear if that continues to go up. It seems as though you're already picking this up 10 or 15 years before people are expected to get sick. And then it gets even higher as people are sick. And what we found in a small study using creatine is that particular marker came down almost, you know, within weeks after people were started. Right. It's really, really cool. And it stays set down for some time. So far, you know, the people that we've been following, those levels have continued to go down. And similarly, the MRIs are very compelling because you can measure changes over time. And there's, again, some indication that we may be seeing an effect. And of course, all this has to only make sense if you have a clinical measure. You know, it doesn't matter if your marker DO is down if it doesn't have an impact on the person or the, you know, the patient or the disease.
A median rate of change with this 8-OH-2-DG?
So the there's no rate of change. What we see when, for example, early on we saw it got an indication that it fell down to healthy levels and it stayed down at that level, for some time. And again, this is all, you know, we're still evaluating the data and looking at it. But again, there's an indicator that this is a marker of oxidative stress. Creatine in particular was used to sort of target oxidative stress, and the fact that you see a reduction certainly implies that you're hitting a target that you thought was important in Huntington's.
Mm-hmm.
And you only know that if it was important if by knocking that target down and following people, you've made a clinical impact on that person's rate of change. So all of these things are things that we're looking at. There may be very different biomarkers. You know, we have blood markers that are showing us changes in very specific pathways. And so I hopefully the goal is to be able to identify those pathways that are prime targets. And many of these are in targets that we have not, we don't really understand fully why they're affected in Huntington's disease. There are some things that we can measure in the blood, for example, that are targets that we know. You know, people in the past have shown changes in certain chemicals in the brain, for example, that now you're finding are also abnormal or altered in Huntington's disease blood in people who are alive and working and, you know, living full lives, but clearly they're important in the disease. And so now we're able to target those things as part of this biomarker. We're still, again, in early stages. We still need to validate the ones that are, in fact, important in HD and find those that actually march along with expected clinical progression. And again, and that's one of the things I think very unique about the CREST-E study is it is the one study that actually includes a biomarker component where we're looking at blood, we're looking at the way the Huntington gene affects the expression of other genes, we're looking at the way that Huntington affects the expression of all these metabolites, these small molecules you can measure in the blood, and we're looking at the way that it affects the brain in addition to the standard clinical measures. The goal here would be...
Do the biological and the neuroimaging markers coincide with rate of progression or stage?
Oh, that's a great question. So one of the things that I sent you was a recent manuscript where we saw that the imaging changes were different, that were depending to some degree on when people got sick. So the younger you were, you know, you are when you get sick, it seems as though the faster your rate of change, and that is something that you see as a clinician. And we're still trying to understand that, and it does, at least our preliminary work, certainly suggests that there may be a difference in some of those other biomarkers, and that's certainly an active area of research, and we hope other researchers will start looking into that as well. You know, we have some very old patients who get sick, very old, you know, an older stage, you know, up to, you know, we have some patients who are in their 80s who are just getting sick now. And so clearly there's something that's different about those patients from patients who get sick when they're 25, and certainly even juvenile patients, obviously, who, you know, we know that those, the patients who have very large repeats can get sick very young. But these are people who have, you know, the gene is expressed between the normal ranges of 40 and 45, you know, and those are the typical ranges that we see in most of our patients. And even then, there's an incredible variability in terms of when people start getting sick. And so we're starting to, you know, we're really looking at exactly, you know, some of the other things that can indicate or go along with progression or maybe explain
what about the regions of interest in the brain? I mean, are you finding correlations with stage in that as well?
What we are finding is that the brain in Huntington's is affected in a very specific way. So if you look at brain scans, and this is something that we've seen in looking at data from other groups as well, there are areas of the brain that seem to be more vulnerable earlier on, and then eventually over time, most of the brain is affected. But it's also possible that not only are the areas of the brain different, but also that the rate of change is going to vary depending on, you know, what stage of the brain. What's really interesting is that some of the most affected areas are areas that are in what we call primary cortices. Now, these are areas that are very energetically demanding. They require a lot of energy to keep working. So we're looking at areas in a part of the brain called the motor strip. So it's, you know, you would expect that in a movement disorder where there are impaired voluntary movements that would be affected. But there are other areas that we're still trying to understand a little bit more why they are. So parts of the brain involved in vision and higher level visual associations are also affected. So we're trying to understand again how that happens. But again, the interesting point here is that many of them are, again, highly energetically demanding areas. And we do know that in Huntington's disease, there is an energetic defect, which is why many of the, you know, the CREST-D study, I think, was initially one of the reasons it was formulated, that because of the energetic defect, that seems to wreak havoc on a very delicate balance. And hopefully by providing additional energy, that will help the disease, slow down the brain changes, the brain degeneration, and make a difference in the disease.
It seems the metabolism is affected drastically.
Yes, it is. There's right. No question. They're it's severely impaired.
Yep. Let me break in here just for a minute. We're way past our 15-minute mark.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. It happens, and time flies when you're having fun. So time to break in for announcements real quick. You're listening to Health for HD. This is Melissa, your host, and our incredible special guest tonight is Dr. Diana Rosas. She's MD, doctor, who is director of the Center for Neuroimaging at Mass General, and we're talking about CREST-D tonight, neuroimaging. Fascinating stuff. Our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. That's the toll-free. Please call in and ask questions. We are recording live, but you can listen again right after the end of the show. Just give it about half an hour to an hour to propagate through the website. Quick announcements here. I just want to also mention that, you know, this show has only been going on since November of last year, and we already have 7,100 listeners, and that's a cumulative number, of course. But, you know, I'm going to continue to do this program as long as I can. I am looking for people who are willing to do a little bit of hosting to help out, and that would be wonderful if somebody out there would like to help out. August 8th, we have our official premiere of Help for JHD, and we have special guests BJ View and Carla Kroll next week on the second Monday each month. We will be featuring a special Help for JHD program, which will focus on our JH dear families. And August 15th, Huntington's Disease Film Project, James Valvano will be on the show again. Yay! Go to www.wehaveaface.org. James Film Project, it is an international project. He has 73 countries that have viewed the trailer now. The Mexican HD Association has sent in 15 videos of participation, incredible amount of interest, and we need to get him funded so that he can complete the project. So any ideas, please give us a call or email James Valvano at wehaveaface@aol.com. And August 22nd, To Care Part 2 with Dr. Merritt. Can you say that name for me?
Dukovic.
Good for it. I totally butchered her name, and I so apologize. August 29, Diana Dunkelberger, The Immune System, the Role of Cannabinoid Receptors in the Pathogenesis of Huntington's Disease. She'll be here from the Michalski Lab at UCSF. And don't forget, new group on Facebook, Help for HD, Help HSG Awareness. It's an open group. We want you there. Make comments and check out On Demand and upcoming episodes. I'll be posting more information about upcoming shows. And now we're back with Dr. Diana Rosas. And we are really going all over the map today on our script, but that's okay. Diana, how many people are you treating? I hear that you have more experience than anyone in the world in treating HD with creatine.
I think that came from a biased source, but no, we're really fortunate. We have a wonderful clinic here. We have about 200 to 300 families, and then we have a lot of those come to participate in our research. So I'm very fortunate to have a pretty large group of people that I've been exposed to and work with. And families who have just been tremendous.
Now, we're talking about biomarkers, and I kind of wanted to ask you about genotype and phenotype correlations. What is that?
Well, you know, I think people are born with the gene, and yet there are so many, there's what we call just a lot of phenotypic variability. There are, you know, not everyone... The expression of the disease, of Huntington's disease, can be very different. Even within families, some people, not only just onset, but also in terms of the symptoms. So some people have very prominent and early movements as the main problem. Other people have psychiatric problems as the initial thing. And others have just a lot of cognitive problems. So it's very, very variable, even though you have the same gene. So the gene itself only accounts for a little bit of the, you know, in terms of onset, about 40 or 50% does it explain the onset. But there are other genetic modifiers and environmental modifiers that are very, very important. And so that when we're looking at some of the phenotypic, variability and trying to understand that, we're looking at things outside of the CAG repeat, the expansion that causes Huntington's, to explain why there is this.
Explain what phenotype is.
Phenotype is what it looks like, basically.
Okay.
What are a patient's symptoms? So that's a phenotype, basically.
And that can show up at any time.
The Huntington's is a very complicated disease. You know, you can have things start, and then over time, people develop other symptoms. And so we have to understand in neurology, it's all about what parts of the brain are affected. And I think that's really important to understand that as we're looking at, you know, other trials. We're looking at possibly stopping the gene using interfering RNA, which you should have a great section on that. That would be a really interesting thing, ways to stop Huntington from being made in the first place. Where do you put these little viruses or these pieces of naked RNA that go in there and try to stop Huntington from being made in the first place. I mean, ideally, you want to get it everywhere. You may not be able to, so you need to kind of understand, you know, where to go, what is causing problems for patients, you know, and that's what you need to target. So looking at targeted delivery systems, you need to understand where things are happening and what's causing these symptoms that people are experiencing that are functionally very limiting.
Right, and some people start out with slight symptoms and then progress. Others just kind of start out, right?
Well, you know, it's a progressive disorder, so you can expect everybody to progress, but how they progress and what symptoms are progressing when are very, very variable.
Mm-hmm. I know with my son, keg repeat of 42, but he has more of the juvenile Huntington's symptoms. And his symptoms started, I remember, as a young boy, he had tremors. And,
tremors.
You know, mm-hmm. I didn't realize, because I was divorced from his dad, that this was a symptom.
They're very variable. And, you know, tremors you do see in juvenile, and you have can have seizures. And again, you see slightly different things as people get older. And so you have to be prepared to understand that. And we have some individuals who are very slow and have very little chorea, but they're much slower and stiffer. And so we need to understand what's called phenotypic variability. You have the same gene that's causing this problem, but it's showing up in different types of symptoms in different people. And so I think that's one of the reasons it makes it particularly difficult to do clinical studies. Clinical trials is in part because of that. And again, the hope is in the development of other biomarkers, other indicators, you may be able to use those in your therapeutic studies to determine if this drug is making a difference.
Do you think that the neuroimaging can really bridge kind of some of that unknown territory?
I would hope so. I think that we're learning an awful lot about what goes wrong in Huntington's. And, you know, imaging is being used in a number of other disorders and in Alzheimer's and in Parkinson's, and we're learning a lot of things about the brain. And as in imaging modalities, there are newer and newer things you can do, and the magnets get better, the resolution, what you can see and how you can see it is just getting better over time. And it's just for us to be creative about understanding that the brain is a series of areas that are talking to each other. And when those communications break down, that creates symptoms. And we also have to understand that, you know, things happen as we get older. And so we need to understand what's happening as you get older and also what's happening that's very unique about disorders of the nervous system like Huntington's disease. But, yes, I think there's an incredible potential for imaging to give us a lot more information than we have now.
How long have you actually been doing the imaging?
I've been doing imaging for about 17 years.
Oh, wow. So you've really seen some changes then.
There have been a lot of changes.
In technology, and also you've probably followed quite a number of people.
Yes, I have. And I think, you know, the technology's gotten better. The tools, not only are the scans better and the magnets better that we use, but also the tools to analyze them have gotten much, much better. They're much more sensitive, and as you gain sensitivity, also it can gain noise. So you have to understand how to deal with the technology, the limitations of the technology, and what you can and cannot say.
Right. Now, is imaging used for CRESTI specifically? Are you following that with imaging as well?
CRESTI is the first study in Huntington's to use imaging. And it's a sub-study, again, with the hope that we may be able to gain experience, know what we can expect in a clinical trial, a multi-center study. I've been doing an imaging sort of biomarker development for, again, about 15 to 17 years as a separate part of my study. But this is, I think, a critical juncture to move into the drug issues and understand that if we can gain sensitivity, you may be able, with imaging or other biomarkers, to make studies much more efficient. So you don't have to get so many patients.
Let me just stop you real quick. I've got to conclude the live portion of the show already.
Oh, my goodness.
Can
okay, great.
People reach you at your email?
Yes, and there's also a website for the CREST e-study if anyone's interested, which I think is posted. It's www.huntington-study-group.org.
Okay.
And there's a lot more information about studies, this CREST e-study and about biomarkers. And, yes, they can certainly reach me through email.
Okay, we're off the live portion in a couple of seconds, so thank you for tuning in. And please don't hesitate to contact me with any questions at helpforhd@yahoo.com. And we're done. It goes fast, doesn't it?
Oh, my God. That's awesome. That was super fast.
I know. I like your idea about having an RNA show. Who do you suggest we get for that one?
There's a really great guy. He's a scientist, but he's not a neurologist, but he's a clinician. So he's actually an endocrinologist.
Oh.
He's awesome. His name is Neil Aronin.
Okay.
A-R-O-N-I-N.
Is he the one that was on the YouTube video about RNA?
You know, I don't know. Is he on the YouTube?
I don't know. There was one really informative RNA video. It was kind of silly in some ways. But in other ways, it was very explanatory in that, you know, for us lay people, it really explained how.
He does a great job with lay stuff.
Yeah.
Hopefully I didn't see too many big terms. I tried not to. But Neil Aronin is great.
We're still recording, and we can still talk. If you'd like to continue talking, I still have some more questions about the neuroimaging. It's just so fascinating to me. And like you said, you know, you started 17 years ago, so you've seen a big change in resonance, probably, I'm sure. And I'd just like to know a little bit more about how and how often you do the imaging with the CREST-E and more on the particulars about that. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So in the CREST-E study, MGH is a main site. There are a few other sites that are involved in CREST-E that are also scanning patients. That includes University of Rochester, Washington University in St. Louis, and then Westmead in Australia.
Wow.
And then we also have a few people who are welcome to send patients to Boston for scans also. The scans are once a year. And we're blinded as to what people are taking. So, as you know, CREST-E is a placebo-controlled blinded study. So they come, and we'll analyze those scans in group analysis once everyone has completed the study. It's about an hour. We collect information about both the structure of the brain and about the connections to see if we can get some indicator that the creatine is actually slowing the changes and the rate of change in this group of people.
Is imaging hard for the HD patients?
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I get the question of, you know, what about the movements? And and frankly, the movements are never a problem. We have not had to, we don't give people any medication when they come. And people have asked when they're worried that they're claustrophobic, and we find that it doesn't really help them relax. We have people who go in and help hold their hands and do that. And it's always been surprising that we lose very little data. People are able just to relax, and when they relax, the movements are not a problem at all. And we position them and things like that. So, no, we have not had any major problems with people being scanned. And we do have people who come in for part of our biomarker development project, and they come every 6 months. And so we do have a lot of data in these individuals, and it gives us information both about the disease progression but also about the tools that we're using so we can look at how reliable they are over time.
Are you also looking at baseline scans from maybe previous scans, or do you only take current scans?
for the CREST E study, we do a very specific research protocol that is only available at the centers that I've just indicated. We actually travel to each of the centers to set them up, and so they're the same sequences that were actually developed by a physicist that I work with, who make sure to install the same thing across all of those because we have a relatively small number of people that we're doing. It won't be all the patients who are participants of the study. It'll just be a small group of them, and so we wanted to be as careful about collecting the same quality scans at each site.
Mm-hmm. Will you be doing scans for other trials in the future?
You know, I think if we can show that this is a feasible a way to go, I think this is a wave of the future. That this there's cost to the scans; they're not inexpensive, but it kind of the whole hope here is that it'll balance out. The cost of the scan will be balanced basically by the reduction in the total number of people that you actually need to study. And our hope is to make them, again, more efficient, meaning not only fewer people, but a shorter observation periods that will allow you to determine if this drug is working at hitting its target at slowing the progression of disease. It's not been validated by the FDA. The FDA has to accept it as what we call a surrogate endpoint, an endpoint that they would accept instead of or in addition to clinical evaluations for people who participate. So it needs to be validated, and the only way it's going to be validated is if it's actually done in conjunction with a study. Our hope is that creatine will show slowing of progression. If it does and the imaging correlates with that or shows that it follows the same trajectory, then there's a good chance that it would maybe accepted, if not as a primary, as a secondary endpoint for the next set of studies.
Right. So we've talked about biomarkers. What are the specific biomarkers that you're looking at?
Well, in the CREST-E study, the biomarkers are imaging is one of them. We're looking at metabolites, small molecules. We had some indications that some of these small molecules are altered in patients who have Huntington's, and so we're reevaluating those. We also have, from a small pilot study, some indication that creatine is actually changing those to more mm-hmm. healthy levels, and so we'll be following those as well. And then there's the one that was mentioned before, 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine. And finally, we'll be looking at the expression of other RNAs, other proteins, other genes that may be affected in Huntington's, with the hope that maybe the creatine will also change those to a more normal pattern. And so we have a huge number. I mean, this is the first study ever that's been done. And I think of this as, in a way, a win-win situation. You're going to get critical information about Huntington's, about a response to a treatment, so that's a pharmacodynamic response, and the hope is here that you'll get information that down the road will be very useful both at looking at endpoints, biomarkers for clinical trials, but also the possibility of identifying other critical targets for drug discovery.
Wow.
That's the goal, and I think we actually have some indication that can happen and will happen.
It sounds like you're on the road with that.
Let's hope so.
If we can just speed things up.
We're a little slow in the recruitment. I think that we can't do this without people participating, we're hoping that people come and call the centers and get involved. I think it's just such an incredibly important study that gives us not just information about the creatine and creatine response, but about Huntington's, and will set the stage, we hope, for future studies to make them better. So we're hoping that people, get involved in the study.
Well, one of the reasons why I'm doing this show is to get the word out, and I'm trying to promote it wherever I can. So I hope that you and your colleagues can also go to, Help for HD and send those links out to your colleagues, to their HD communities, and spread the word that, we're talking about it. We need to get it done.
And we can't get it done without people actually participating in these studies.
Right.
And you know, it's most people who participate for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And most people will tell you it's a very rewarding thing to do because all of the, you know, we've been fortunate to work with a very tight HSG community. And everyone who does research, all of the principal investigators are really wonderful people who believe. And they're just very special clinicians. And so I think what you hear from people when they come, you know, from other sites is how wonderful the each of the, you know, their experience has been with the research staff at their site. And that's always a great thing. That's and again, that's, I think, unique to Huntington's, where you have these wonderful physicians who take care of complicated medical and neurological problems. And again, what we hear is that it's always been a positive experience.
Are you on Facebook?
No.
Okay. I was going to say, if you're on Facebook, to go to the group that we created for HSG. It's called Help for HD, Help HSG Awareness. And, you know, I'm kind of trying to encourage our researchers and clinical trial PIs to go there. If you're not a Facebook member, you know, do a Facebook quick profile and go join the group, because you know, I'm trying to garner support from the HD community there, explain, you know, what these clinical trials are about. There's a lot of mystique around clinical trials still, even though that they've been going on for quite a while, and try to help people understand why they're important and why they need to be involved, and what the benefit is going to be to them and to their family, maybe not necessarily them specifically right now. We're in a society that is, you know, instant gratification is where we're what we're looking for, and this is not one of those cases where, you know, it's going to be instantly help, but we can leave a legacy to our family members, our loved ones, that you know, we've participated in these trials and we've contributed to, you know, ultimately the treatments and cure for the disease. So
all I can
really
tell
important.
You is that we, you know, that we've come this far. We've actually shaved 3 years or 4 years off of a study because we had 10 people who came in every 2 weeks for basically almost a year to participate
wow.
in our research. And, you know, they've just been diehards. And it's without them, we wouldn't be where we are now. And, you know, it's just every person has so much they can give, and they don't realize how much they can give to others. And you know, the goal is eventually come back hundredfold, we hope. But, you know, we're learning so much about this disease because we have people who are so generous of their time and are also generous with their trust in what we do. And one thing that we do is, you know, we are sworn, you know, the Hippocratic Oath is do no harm, and we all take that very, very seriously when we're working with participants in the clinical trial. That is the number one, two, and three thing that we watch for is someone's safety. You know, again, most of the people that have participated have a very positive experience, and they tell us. And, you know, it's being in a trial is being part of an extended research family. You know, you get to know people. They see you frequently, and it's a very supportive environment. So I would encourage people to at least try it out and see what it's like.
So how many more do you need for the CRESTI study?
The recruitment now is at about 220 or so. So we're looking at trying to get 600 patients to participate, to volunteer. So we're about a third there. So you know, the sooner we can get the number of people to participate and, you know, complete the enrollment that we need, the sooner we get our information and we can get it out there and disseminate whether or not this is, you know, working. But we need to get those numbers, and the sooner the better.
Mm-hmm. And we can go to www.huntington-study-group.org, or you can also go to YouTube. There's a video Dr. Hirsch has done that can explain things. And 800 number is 800-487-7671. Can people reach out to you, Dr. Rosas?
Oh, absolutely.
And can you give us your contact information?
Sure. It's Rosas, R-O-S-A-S, at helix.mgh.harvard.edu.
Great. And you can email Dr. Rosas with information or questions. And I just thank you. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I'm just completely fascinated by the imaging, the neuroimaging. And I look forward to hearing more about your work.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. I really have enjoyed this, and I can't believe so much time has gone so quickly. And thank you for your support of Cresty and all our projects.
I hope we can get more people going and get more involvement and more excitement about it. It really is exciting work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, and have a great evening. We'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.